So we come towards the end, it's not ended yet, and we still have time for some closing words and for some meditation. So far we've been cultivating our meditation in a fairly systematic way, but to end the retreat we're going to spread whatever loving kindness we've developed with all beings further afield, as far as it will go. So we'll do that shortly, and then we'll have an opportunity to share together. We'll probably move our chairs, I think, move our cushions and sit in a circle, so we can just speak and share anything we wish with one another, and practice some kindful listening at the same time. And you only need to speak if you wish, if something comes to mind that you wish to share from your heart, and it can be anything at all, and everyone else's job is just to hold the space and listen with kindly ears, with non-judgment and with a sense of genuine interest and compassion. So this is a really beautiful practice we can do before we leave. And then finally there'll be a little bit of informal conversation in the lounge. Tea and I think the steamed chocolate to end the meditation. So it's really important actually to learn how to make these transitions skillfully. Because here on retreat, we've had a really precious opportunity to cultivate mainly the last two factors of the path. Samasati, right mindfulness, or right kindfulness, because mindfulness should carry with it the intention of loving kindness, the attitude of non-ill will and compassion and letting go. And also, of course, to deepen our stillness, to allow the mind to really quieten down and experience increasing levels of serenity and peace through the practice of loving kindness. And this gives results. You know, you might not have experienced all the results yet. You probably continue to experience benefits in your daily life. And yet, those benefits might not be as obvious as they are on retreat. You might not always experience the effects of retreat or the effects of your practice in the form of a peaceful mind or even a particularly loving, open heart. And that is okay. That's to be expected. This is just a two-day retreat, and hopefully it gives you a taste of what could be possible or a taste for getting more experience. You know, it's like a little, you go to the supermarket, you see a little taster and you take it because it's free or whatever, and it makes you want to buy the product, right? So in the same way, hopefully, when you hear that there's a 7-day metta retreat or a 10-day metta retreat or any kind of retreat, you'll think, yes, I'm ready for this. I'm ready to go a bit deeper in this. But it mustn't be thought of that practice outside is any less important. In fact, most of our life is not on retreat. And so whatever we do in our life, we need to learn to align it with the Eightfold Path, which means you can regard whatever you do as strengthening one factor or the other. So when you're at work, you're strengthening the factor of livelihood. And even if you don't think that your livelihood is particularly ethical, you can't always see how it helps people, nonetheless, you know, you can bring more love, more kindness, more of a sense of service to whatever you do, and then it becomes your right livelihood and your right attitude combined. And of course, there's speech and there's action. And yesterday in the lounge, actually, somebody said to me, isn't love an action? I always thought it was. And I completely agree. You know, we can have the sentiment of loving kindness, may all beings be happy. And for some of us, that might be quite easy when those beings are not actually in front of us. We can imagine they are, but they're not, right? They're not actually triggering us in any particular way. But to actually take the sentiment into action, into loving action, is another skill entirely, and this is where we can put our practice to the test. I don't often quote from other religions or traditions, but there is a beautiful poem by, I think, Khalil Gibran, and there's more to it than this, but one of the sentences I like the best in this poem is, "Work is love made visible. Work is love made visible." I find this so beautiful. And that love is made visible to me in my everyday life by the people I live with and who serve in the monastery. It's such a beautiful thing to be around because I can see not only the small deeds that they do, but more importantly, where it's coming from. And sometimes, as I was saying, they don't need to be done. But sometimes people do them anyway, just to express a sense of care. Yeah. So I think it's important in our practice to move from, to make a smooth transition and also to find space in our life for solitude, but also to be able to make a beautiful integrated transition from that into not a codependent kind of relationship with the people we're around, but a kind of healthy interdependency. And I don't know if this is quite the same thing, but I was reading earlier today an ancient African, not exactly a proverb, a kind of, it's a word, Ubuntu. Has anybody heard of Ubuntu? Yeah? Some people are laughing. Maybe, have you just spoken about it or something?
I was born in South Africa.
You were born in South Africa, so you know more than about this than me. But, well, I'm sure you do. But as I understand it, I was just watching this little video, and this white guy, it's always a white guy, right, or a white woman, comes to a country in Africa, and I don't know where it was, and they say to these three black children, really young, about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old, oh, you know, I've got a bag of goodies, maybe it's some fruit or some chocolate or something, why don't you kind of stand on the start line and race to see who can get there first, and the one who gets there gets the goodies. And you know what they do? They all sort of stand together, and then when he goes, go, and they all hold hands and they walk there together. And this cameraman's like, what is this? You know, why didn't you do that? Didn't you want to get it for yourself? And they just said, Ubuntu. And Ubuntu means something like, I am because we are. In other words, I can only exist because of us, because of friendship, because of community, because of healthy interdependency. And that's really similar, isn't it, to what the Buddha is teaching in right view. You know, the fact that suffering, yes, is a noble truth, but suffering is universal. We're not supposed to just sit with our suffering and think, oh, this is me, this is my problem, what am I going to do? The Buddha said it is a universal problem that has a universal solution. And it's a solution that can be applied to us no matter where we're from, no matter who we are, no matter, again, how clever or, you know, not so bright or capable or not. It's nothing to do with ability. It's to do with simply applying a path and walking on that path to the best of our ability. So we always start from where we are. So this is our opportunity to move into the world with a sense of being willing to serve. You know, whenever I find my teacher, it's really sweet. I've stopped answering his question now because I want to know how he is. Somebody asked me yesterday, how are you? And I was like, that's so sweet to ask. But usually when I phone Ajahn Brahm, he says, how can I be of service? And it's just the sweetest reception, you know, that I can imagine. It's words of loving kindness. It's a willingness to be of service, to help however he can. And this is an expression of love, isn't it? How can I be of service? Because a person with true loving kindness just wishes to further another person's spiritual growth. That's the highest form of kindness. Sometimes it involves material support. Sometimes, I mean, actually from a teacher like Ajahn Brahm, it involves all of these things. Material, emotional, spiritual, practical, you know, everything's covered pretty much. But of course, one person can't cover that for us alone. We need to form communities. We need to learn how to live cooperatively with one another, with eyes of mutual respect, and including the more vulnerable members of any community or any society as well, the less privileged, the marginalized, the ones we don't understand, and make efforts to understand those people too. So I wanted to talk a little bit about overcoming resentment, because this is one of the things we're likely to encounter when we come back in contact with one another. And of course, resentment or ill will. Resentment, in a way, is like ill will dug deep. It's kind of like the layers that have been pressed down and become solid in the mind, and we carry all this old stuff with us, you know, and it really weighs us down and becomes kind of like this thick, rocky layer in the heart if we're not careful. So the Buddha talked about certain ways to overcome this, because it's obviously a great impediment to harmony and peace and love in our communities if we're carrying this kind of, yeah, resentment inside. You might think you can hide it for a while, yeah, but Maybe you just don't sleep well one night, and if you have this lingering irritation with somebody, you're likely to let your guard down, and it's going to come out in the form of harsh words. Somewhere in the suttas it actually says, I don't know if this is actually in the Nidanas, or anyway, maybe not in the main body of the suttas, but it says that we're born with an axe in our mouth. With an axe in our mouth. I don't know, but when we were kids at school, they used to say, oh, such and such has got a sharp tongue. In fact, I was told that once. I was once called to the headmaster's office, which was very scary because I was a really good girl, but this time I'd become a little bit irritated with someone, and I think I scratched them, and I was called to the headmaster's office. And actually, he sort of probably was a bit biased because I was quite clever and quite a good girl normally, so he just kind of said, never mind, you know, it's just that you've got a sharp tongue. I don't know why he said that, because actually it was sharp nails. But anyway, I've confessed. I've forgotten about that until now. But it's good, isn't it? Because when you're actually teaching the dummy, you have to just be real. So yeah, I did scratch this girl because she wouldn't lend me her roller boots. She was my sister's friend as well. So she was younger. She was like my little sister's age. She should do what I say. Right? I wanted to show off how good I was with roller boots. Anyway, so that was what happened. It wasn't a sharp tongue, but my nails were a little bit long. So we have to guard our tongue. We have to guard this, you know, capacity we have to cause harm, because once it's out, you can't put it back in. Right? And so there's a sutta where the Buddha talks about ways. In fact, I think it's Sariputta. Talks about five ways. Who's the sutta expert? Is it Sariputta? I think it is. Five ways of overcoming resentment. And this is really interesting because there's also like a point where practice meets the outside world. It's a combination of virtue at the level of body and speech, and starting to guard the mind, so what we call sense restraint, using our perceptions and the way we view and regard others in a skillful way. So he said that there are different kinds of people, and these are just examples, but in some cases we might meet people whose bodily action is impure. In other words, they do things that are unskillful, unwholesome, but their verbal action is pure. So they still sometimes speak politely or kindly, but they don't do very good things. And of course, everyone's a combination, right? But from time to time, this is what arises. And he said, it's like you're walking along the street, probably in ancient India, but maybe in, I don't know, in a Finnish forest, I'm not quite sure, and you find a dirty rag on the floor. And in the Buddha's day, these robes were made with rags. You can still see that it has what we call a paddy field design, so it has like individual pieces that are stitched together, because we're not supposed to wear fine cloth. We're meant to find just strips of fabric and stitch them together. So one of the practices in those times was to be a rag robe wearer, and I'm not, because this was made for sure in Bangkok on a sewing machine with commercial dye, but still we use this pattern. And so in this simile, the person finds a piece of dirty old rag on the floor and initially thinks to discard it, but then realizes, hang on a minute, what if I remove a piece of this dirty rag by holding one foot down and using my other foot to tear it, and then I get down and pick it up by the edge and take the good piece, and then go off, wash the good piece, and use it to stitch the robe. So in the same way, when a person's bodily action is impure but their verbal action is okay, maybe it's even good, we can just tear that apart from the action. In other words, we disregard the bodily action and we just encourage the good, wholesome verbal action. It doesn't mean we don't know that the bad bodily action's there, but it might mean that we try and engage with the good verbal action and encourage that quality in the person. So this is how we kind of feed, again, the wolf, the black wolf, the good wolf, right? And we starve the bad wolf. And then the next simile, as you can imagine, is the good bodily behaviour, but the impure verbal behaviour. And you might have met people like this who are quite harsh with their speech. They use kind of rough language, and you think, gosh, what kind of person is this? They seem a bit common. We don't speak like that in my family. But actually, they spend their whole life serving. And some of these people might be, you know, from less privileged communities. They might have really menial jobs, and they just do it because it's a good thing to do, and they have to support a family. And they do it from the love of their heart. You know, they're the kind of people we call the salt of the earth. They might seem unrefined, but, you know, they're actually working really hard to support the rest of us, actually, quite often. And in this case, he said it's like there's algae on a pond. So the algae is like the bad speech. All you have to do is just remove the algae aside, and then you can drink from the water in the pond. Yeah? And then, of course, there's a person who doesn't have very good speech or behaviour. But sometimes they get some peace of mind. Sometimes there are some good qualities there that come through. And the Buddha said in this case it's like a puddle of water, like really dirty water that you find like after a storm. You know, it's kind of muddy and pretty horrible, but still you're thirsty. So in this case you have to get down on all fours and you have to cup your hands and just very, very carefully take out some of the water so that you can drink that water. If you go down too fast or if you stir that water up, it's going to be impossible to drink. So you approach this person carefully. You have to look very carefully for the good in them, and then you can relieve yourself of that ill will, right? Because this is all about purifying ourself, remember. It's not about trying to see the person as they really are, because there is no real person there, and the person can change from time to time. But it's about not allowing our minds to fixate on things that lead to resentment and that lead to hardening of the heart. So then the next one is a person who never gets any good qualities coming to their mind. Or at least not yet. Ajahn Brahm always says, not yet. Don't say, oh, I haven't got into jhanas. Oh, I haven't got any peace. You have to say, yet. Okay. So this person is the not yet person. And in this case, the Buddha said we have to regard them basically as a sick person who's lost their way and who doesn't have an attendant, who doesn't have any medicine, who's far away from the next village, far away from a place to rest. And what should one do in that case? One simply has to arouse sheer compassion and tender concern for such a person who's sick. You know, not only are they sick, but they're actually unable to get help. And I'm sure we all know people like this, or we read about people like this, or we see political leaders like this who have a lot of power, and it's scary to see this. You know, but it's even scarier to understand the laws of karma and how much that person is suffering already, and how much terrible karma, how many terrible kind of seeds they're planting for the future as well, because that's going to have to come up at some point. And, you know, it looks like they're a very, very long way from peace. They can't even hear reason. You know, even when compassionate people come to try and speak to them, they just turn away. They say, this is a terrible thing to say. Does anybody see that horrible... Well, actually not really horrible, it was powerful, but it was very sad. It was a female, I'm not very good with Christianity, I don't know if she was an Anglican bishop or something, but she spoke at President Trump's inauguration, and she pleaded with him, you know, from a place of nobility and courage, actually, and from a place that was absolutely aligned with Christ's message, as best we can understand, to have compassion. You know, and she spoke to him with respect. And him and his wife were sitting there looking absolutely hateful. And afterwards she received death threats and, you know, she was kind of bullied. Oh, you're not a real American, she should be deported and all of this. And so, my goodness, even when they're spoken to like this, there's no way they can turn around. So we have to just have sheer compassion. These people are sick. And protect our hearts. Because if we allow other people's sickness to infect us, then, you know, where is the opportunity to turn things around? Instead, it's much better to let happiness be contagious. Have you heard that disease? The hepatitis? Sorry, that's an Ajahn Brahm joke.
That's not like an Ajahn Brahm joke.
Happy-titus. So we have to infect each other with smiles, not with thoughts of cruelty. So we arouse compassion and tender concern. And then, interestingly, the last person in this little list of those who we might feel resentment towards is a person who's pure in bodily action and in speech. A person who might even be a noble person. Still, we can have resentment to them. You know, how many people here have ever felt jealous of someone who's doing well in life? Honestly. Yeah, thanks for admitting it. Huh? Probably me too. I can't pinpoint, but you know. Or you go on retreat and you hear that somebody on their first retreat got into deep meditation and you've been practicing, I don't know, 10 years and you haven't had much peace at all. How many of you feel kind of like, I don't know why this person deserves it. They're not so much better than me. You know, I actually have a better livelihood and I'm getting better with my precepts. Right? Because we're measuring things in a linear way. So, unfortunately, we can develop resentment even to these people. And the Buddha said, instead of that, try and see these people as the shade of a tree. You know, these people are like places that we can go to learn. We have to humble ourselves a little bit, but maybe they have some qualities that we can get inspired by. Why not, you know? Sure, you might have been practicing longer. You might have better ethical conduct. Maybe they had beginner's luck. But the fact is, you know, they have some goodness inside them, maybe a lot of goodness. There are people who are jealous of Ajahn Brahm who say, oh, he's not enlightened. Poof, how can somebody like that, you know, who cracks all those jokes, how can they be enlightened? I mean, that's a shame for them, right? Because then they're closed to the possibility of learning from such an incredible teacher with so much wisdom, not only stillness, but a lot of wisdom as well. So these are some of the ways that we can start to play with perception, if you like, and start to check out how we're regarding other people who we may be too quick to judge. And I had so much more I want to say, and as usual, the time's going too fast. But I did want to talk about a lovely, some research findings around including people in our societies that often we shut out or we judge. And to me, this is an extension of compassion in community, in society. So one of these I read a few years ago was about some psychological research done with people who were addicts. So they would go into places, you know, like rehab centres or whatever, with people who were addicted to various substances. And they realised that the usual treatment didn't really work. And that most of the people that had addictions in adult life were actually had experienced trauma in their past. The vast majority, yeah. You know, it's not that everybody who's traumatized will go on to have addictions. It's not that everybody who's an addict has been traumatized, but there's a very, very strong correlation there. And having understood this, they realized that the opposite of addiction wasn't punishment, it wasn't confinement, it wasn't being made to abstain even. The opposite of addiction is connection. And actually developing a sense of belonging and being treated with respect. So then they started to run these programs, I think it was in Spain, to give people with addictions an opportunity to serve their communities, to give them a sense of purpose and a feeling of self-dignity. I actually had a friend who died last year. She was a psychoanalyst and a really brilliant woman. And she said that her husband was so distraught by her death. He was Thai, actually. But she was more of a Buddhist. She was actually practicing Buddhism. And he wasn't really a practitioner. And she said his whole family had an alcohol problem and he was likely just to sink into alcoholic depression. He wouldn't even come and see her in the hospice because he just couldn't cope with the fact that she was suddenly dying. One minute she was fine and, you know, she went to hospital thinking she still had symptoms of COVID and she was told, actually, you're in the fourth stage of a really quickly progressing bowel cancer and you've got a couple of months to live. So he just couldn't cope and couldn't take care of himself. But she told me the last time I saw her, I think, that in Thailand there's a monastery there where some of his family members have already ordained and it's got them out of their alcohol addiction because it gives them a sense of respect and service. They're looked up to by the people in the village. And at first I thought, oh, but is that the right reason to be a monk? But then I realised in a Buddhist culture, the fact that it can fulfil all these functions is actually quite incredible. And she said that he'd already mentioned to her that if she dies or when she dies, that might be what he chooses to do, to become a monk for the rest of his life. And it's a much better choice, isn't it, than being, you know, wallowing and washing away your sorrow with alcohol. And I thought that was quite amazing, really, because monks are given a lot of respect, and maybe that's the start of the healing process for many of us. The other article I wanted to mention that I read in the Times when I visited my family this Christmas is a beautiful article about a UK institute called Oasis Restore. And it's another kind of prison for juvenile offenders, which means kids. Apparently in England we have the lowest age, 10 years old, that kids can be convicted, which is shocking. 10 years old, and they can be held responsible, you know, for their crime. And again, a lot of these kids, if not all of them, come from very difficult family situations, you know, really deprived areas. Maybe they haven't even learned to read or write. And they get mixed in with the wrong crowd and, you know, and end up doing things they later regret. But this place is different, and it doesn't even call itself a prison. Although it's a secure unit, it actually calls itself a school. And one of the key differences is that they don't ask the kids who come in, the criminals, inverted commas, they don't ask them, what did you do wrong? They ask them, what happened to you? What happened to you in your life? It's completely different, right? It's compassion as opposed to judgment. And this is one of the principles of compassion, that we start to actually try and understand, try and put ourselves in their shoes and realise, in their situation, how do I know I'd be any different? In fact, it's quite likely that that situation is the cause of this person behaving this way. So this already gives them a sense of restored dignity and respect. And this is their aim, to give them a sense of responsibility, understanding what they've done and how they've harmed society, and choices. You know, they get to choose things like what kind of bedding they want, and apparently there's lots of stuff for them to use, like computers and other things that most kids take for granted. And one of the kids just burst into tears and said, are we allowed to use all this? You know, it was such a sweet story. And the other thing is to just restore this sense of dignity and respect. And the kids, some of them are, you know, illiterate at the age of 10, 12, 14. And so they're all in different classes, and some have one-to-one guidance just to get them back on track. And I thought that was such a beautiful way of, you know, actually serving people who need that special care and nurture, who maybe haven't had it so far in their lives. So I think, you know, part of our responsibility as compassionate human beings, and as our loving kindness matures and develops, is to start contributing to society in this way, and even creating more equitable societies, more inclusive communities, where we can have this kind of sense of mutual respect and trust, and where we do care for the most vulnerable among us. We care for those who don't have the same access maybe to the Buddha's teachings. Right? In many bhikkhuni monasteries, this is the case. It's not enough just to give full ordination. We also need equal access to the teachings and the teachers. You know, Bansa Sujata has this project at the moment to get lots of his sutta translations bound up with traditionally woven cloth from Sri Lanka and distributed to some of the schools over there, so that the young monks mostly can actually have access to the suttas in English. And also in Sinhala, I suppose, but I think they're probably English medium monasteries as well. And I said, what about the nuns' monasteries? And he said, oh yeah, there must be lots of nuns' monasteries too. We have to find out about that. And the thing is, there are so many fewer, and it doesn't come to people's minds straight away because we've been excluded for so long. You just think, oh, for the monks, right? But it's not enough just to ordain women. We also have to have access to the teachings, to opportunities for retreat. Most of us work really, really hard. We're in leadership roles far too soon, or at least we feel it's too soon. And we have the work of like 10 or 20 people on our shoulders, no exaggeration at all. So we need to look after the people in our communities who have less access to all kinds of things, right? Not just monasteries, of course, but other communities as well. And to include based on shared values, not based on privilege and things like being from the same race or being from the same gender. I actually came to the point now, and this is on tape, but I don't mind, that I feel it's quite unhealthy, actually, to have one group of people from a privileged part of society, such as only men, living together without women living there too. Because what happens is that, say, in a monk's monastery, they tend to feel that everything that's coming to them is just kind of due to them because, oh, it's our karma, you know, we're doing good things as monks, and that's why we're getting fed. And, you know, it's the same for everybody, isn't it? But they don't know that because they never hear from people who it's different for. They never hear a woman's perspective, a nun's perspective, and they might not want to hear that because that might arouse feelings of guilt or it might be a little bit sobering for them to hear. So even recently I was speaking to Ajahn Brahm and he said, you know, some of the problem quite often with people generally is that we live in our bubble. We live in a little bubble and we don't really meet people who are different from us. We need to start getting out of our own circle and actually seeking the input from people who don't have it so easy so that we can, you know, have more empathy and realise that, yeah, we do have a lot. We do have enough to share. So the Buddha talked about six principles of harmony. And this is all about sharing. He said there are six things that conduce to living in harmony, regarding one another with eyes of kindness and mutual respect. The first one is bodily acts of loving kindness in public and in private. See the integrity there again. It's the uprightness, the being, being the same person, whether you're seen and appreciated for your action or not. So bodily acts of loving kindness in public and in private. The next one is verbal acts of loving kindness in public and in private. This is important because we can be kind to people to their face, but what do we say about them behind their back or to other people? You know, are we really promoting harmony or are we sowing seeds of division? And then the other one is mental acts of loving kindness in public and in private. So the way you think about other people conditions how you feel when you meet them, right? If you've been thinking bad thoughts about a person or you've been going over a particular tendency that person has, then when you meet them, that's what you see. Right? Oh, it's that again. They did that again. They said it this way. Right? And you kind of dwell on that. So instead we dwell on the beautiful. We dwell on, you know, the last lovely thing a person did. And we make sure we think thoughts of loving kindness as often as we can. We're conditioning our mind. And the Buddha said, you know, the more we can condition our mind with thoughts of loving kindness, thoughts of non-ill will, thoughts of letting go, this becomes the inclination of the mind. We keep on resorting to that thought again and again and again until it becomes so embedded that it becomes our character. And people can sense, even before we speak, that we mean them no harm because we've been thinking good thoughts about them all the time. And then the last three principles of harmony are sharing things. So this is again where we share our privilege, we share whatever gains we've rightfully received with others. I was just thinking today about my mom because she said, oh, I really admire what you've done and it's really fantastic. And I said, wow, thank you. But what you've done is fantastic. I don't think she ever really notices this. She was a speech and language therapist managing services for adults with learning disabilities for the county that we come from. So she had a big team of like psychotherapists, psychologists, drama therapists, art therapists, all kinds of doctors, and helping people to communicate so that they can function in the world, right? And this is amazing. It was a sacrifice. It wasn't always easy. And because of that, she could raise us. She could provide for us. My dad also, he was a teacher. And I'd never thought of it until today, actually, that whatever I received as a result of that, you know, the food, the place to live, etc., it was rightfully obtained. She shared gains, and this is a phrasing from the suttas, that were rightfully obtained, you know, through good livelihood. And that's beautiful, actually. You know, the fact that I was nurtured and fed was through good actions being done in the world, which I find quite wonderful. So anyway, we share, and in this sutta it says that we share even the contents of our alms bowl with another person. So it's not that, oh, this is my food and that's your food. It's like, why don't we just share whatever we have? And then the other thing is we share virtue in common with our companions. So we look for friends that also have virtue, that are also cultivating beautiful qualities in their heart, because this will encourage us to continue our own practice. And this way we can be gladdened and inspired. And then lastly, we share views in common with our fellow companions. And this doesn't just mean, it doesn't actually mean political views or even views about, I don't know, even Buddhist concepts that you actually haven't experienced, but it means basic alignment with right view. So understanding the suffering, and we're trying to come out of suffering, understanding that it's important to have compassion, it's important to practice ethics, etc., so that we're all on the same page and our communities can operate harmoniously for one purpose, for one goal. Lastly, I got a couple more little quotes written down, which are really nice, but lastly, there's a passage I wanted to share about patience, developing patience, which is a big quality of loving kindness. It has to go hand in hand. And particularly patience under provocation, when you're being tested, put to the test. And there are suttas about this too. So the Buddha says, you know, people may approach you and their words may be filled with loving kindness, or they may approach you with hate. They may approach you in a timely way or an untimely way, for your benefit or for your harm. They may use gentle speech or rough speech. However you're approached, it may be true or untrue, it's important to make a determination thus: my mind will remain unaffected. I shall utter no evil words, no unwholesome, hurtful words. And starting with this person, I will spread loving kindness throughout the whole world. Starting with this person who's upset me, who's approached me in an angry way, I will basically not allow my mind to turn towards ill will, but I will hold their best interest at heart. And I found a beautiful poem by a Black American poet laureate. I'm sure most of you might know her, Maya Angelou. Has anyone read Maya Angelou? And I thought this was a kind of very beautiful, similar thing to say, actually, but in a poetic way. So she was born in 1928 and passed away about 10 years ago. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness. But still, like air, I'll rise. It's like, pretty powerful. Pretty powerful. So this is the kind of standard we're aiming for. And we have to forgive ourselves if we fall short, because we're not noble beings yet, we're not enlightened yet, it's a training. But still, there's never any justification for anger. It's never going to be helpful. It's never going to lead to peace. So as best as possible, we have to find skillful ways to overcome anger and to continue practicing loving kindness. And of course, to surround ourselves by spiritual friends. So lastly, I think we might just have to make the circle a bit shorter. Or the lounge chat, yeah. Because lastly, I did want to just give a few tips for practicing metta in everyday life. That's important, right? Yeah? All right. So, one thing you can do. Any time in your busy day, if you see your mind giving rise to unskillful thoughts, is just to come back to a phrase of loving kindness. I missed this question last night. I apologize to whoever put it here. Could you tell us a beautiful and something mantra for this moment in life? Either true or firm or something. Mantra. And I was thinking about this because I don't use mantras as such, but just here you heard me say something. My mind will remain unaffected. I shall utter no evil words. It's a kind of training of the mind. It's a kind of preparation of the mind. So the thing that came to me that could be used is, I will develop loving kindness for all beings. I will develop loving kindness for all beings. Right? So we can just remember this. We can tell ourselves this before we go out in the morning. I will develop loving kindness for all beings. I will try to keep my mind full of kindness. You know, I'll try to protect my mind from hate. But I like this. I will develop a mind of loving kindness for all beings, or I will develop loving kindness for all beings, because this is something you can actually say to yourself, and it has a beautiful feeling for the mind. Whereas the other ones, they use more negative words, so I think it's good to choose the positive words. So you can resort to things like your phrases at any given time. You can take time in the bathroom. This is an Ajahn Brahm idea, of course, because he likes to talk about bathrooms and things like that. I'm not talking about what happens in the bathroom. That's his job. But, okay, the letting go room. So, but you're constipated, okay, so your boss doesn't really know that, but they're not going to ask. So you might be constipated, so you can take extra time in the toilet. And you can just calm yourself down, and you can actually have thoughts of loving kindness and just collect yourself before you go out again. Take some deep breaths and go out to face whoever's irritating you or whatever situation is ahead. Sometimes it's just tiredness, you just need a rest. Loving kindness is great to practice before you fall asleep. Many of the benefits of loving kindness are for your sleep, so that it helps you have deep sleep, restful sleep, and wake up happy. So if you have thoughts of loving kindness before you sleep, you're likely to wake up with thoughts of loving kindness as well. And I always practice loving kindness after every meditation, even if it's been a loving kindness meditation still. At the end of the meditation, I spread loving kindness to all beings so that it comes away from me and mine and widens the circle to include all beings. If there are any practices you've enjoyed here, or you feel are interesting, or even that you feel are difficult, take them home. Try them again. But my advice would always be to resource yourself before you approach the difficult being, or the difficult person in your life, or even the difficult parts of yourself. So start with the easy and move on, gradually expanding the circle of your loving kindness. It's great if you can have a day-to-day practice. You know, at least half an hour meditation a day, or maybe 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes in the evening. After a while, it becomes as natural and as necessary as having a wash or having some food, having a drink of water. You just don't feel prepared unless you've sat with yourself first thing, or unless you've closed the day by allowing your mind just to settle and rest. So see if you can make loving kindness a really big part of your practice. And again, you know, it doesn't have to be the cultivation. It can also be just the way that you regard whatever arises. So you may be joining retreats with other teachers. They might talk about bare awareness and about mindfulness. But remember, bare awareness is never really objective as long as the hindrances are active. And the hindrances can be so subtle, just like a subtle sense of discontent or dulling out or kind of tensing up. So see if you can just add that bit of extra softness and kindness to the way that you're aware, and then you'll be developing a really beautiful relationship with your mind. And lastly, yes, look after yourselves. Look after yourselves in every way. You know, we have to bring the whole of ourselves to the path. It doesn't mean that because we're cultivating our mind, we neglect our body, or we start starving ourselves because that's what monastics do, or we should wash less, or whatever. Care for your body, get some rest, you know, offer yourself time and space. It's amazing when you have more time and space, you do little kindnesses for yourself. I notice when I practice loving kindness, I end up making my bed really nicely and putting a candle, or I don't know, I just take that extra bit of care. I become much more nurturing of myself. And the last thing we can always, always do so easily and completely for free is just to smile. You know, sometimes people say to me, oh, you go to London and you sit on the train, no one ever smiles. It's like, That's their business. Doesn't mean you can't smile. Actually, if they don't smile, probably somebody has to, right? Who's going to be the first? So be rebellious, because whenever I've smiled at people or said hello on the train, they're super friendly. I just don't believe that people are not friendly. So we have to act the way we want other people to act, in a sense, right? I won't say that really cliched thing. But it's true. It's true. We have to put out the energy that we'd like to receive, and that encourages other people to do the same. So be a light to your fellow companions in society, at work, cooperate, help, share, and life will be that little bit kinder for us all, that little bit more bearable. And when you are going through difficulties, you'll find you have lots of friends. So, that's all from me for now. And it's time to do some more meditation together to end the retreat.